Blog Talk Radio.
Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report. Rising report, it's that Apple report. It's the Rising Apple report.
Yeah! And good evening to my fellow Mets fans out there. This is Rising Apple staff writer Rich Spirago, and I guess we'll call this a happy edition of the Rising Apple Report because everything is good in Metsville. The Mets are 13-7, and with the Nationals' loss this afternoon, find themselves just a skinny half game out of first place. And we were worried, right? Right, you know you were. I kind of was. We all were. But to join me tonight in talking Mets baseball, I have my fellow staff writer and a voice that really on the Rising Apple Report should need absolutely no introduction, Mr. Mike LeCollin. Mike, how are you this evening?
You're too kind. I'm well. Thank you. How are you, my friend?
Doing well. You know, doing well. Like we were talking about as we were preparing a little bit, it's, you know, we're worriers by nature as Met fans. We tend to be cynical, but, you know, right now, the team is just firing on all cylinders. I mean, it looks like a pretty well-oiled machine, you know, from my perspective. And, Mike, let's start there. So the Mets have played 20 games, and although the math is not exact, it's basically an eighth of the season, right, just a shade off of that. So they played an eighth of the season, 13-7, but more than 13-7, it's how they got there. You know, they were 2-5, and they're 11-2 in their last 13, as unbelievable as that might be. So, Mike, general comments. How does 13-7 grab you an eighth of the way through the season? Just go with it.
You know what? If I said, you know, fans, we take things day by day, that would be the pragmatic thing to say or the pragmatic way to go. And there's nothing wrong with living in the moment. You know, it is what it is. It's April. It's April 28th. And like you said, we're just a smidgen away from first place after the Nationals got off to such a brilliant start by comparison, you know. So why not live in the moment and why not be happy and let's go ahead and ponder what the future may hold.
Yeah, and speaking about what the future may hold, I mean, it's, again, doing the math, the Mets are on pace to win over 100 games, and we know that that's silly, you know, an eighth of the way through the season to project out. But if you did this purely on a mathematical basis, they would have a pretty darn solid good year, right? And but, okay, with that said, it's all happy and it's all flowery in Metsville, and we all love it. But, Mike, if I had to ask you now, I'm going to talk out of the other side of my mouth and say let's be Mets fans for a moment and let's find a dark cloud. Is there anything that concerns you about this team 20 games in?
Yeah, obviously what's going on behind the dish. You know, we started the season out saying that catcher is still effectively an open competition. Injury just seems to find Travis d'Arnaud. You know, we have to be careful and say or determine whether he's injury prone. You know, those injuries he incurred in the minor leagues might have been strange ones, oddities. But lately, I mean, now we're talking about a strained rotator cuff, and it was a knee, and it was a hyperextended elbow, or it was a thumb. So, really, Travis d'Arnaud, question mark. And then, you know, Kevin Plawecki, well, this is his big chance, so to say. One man's injury is another man's opportunity.
So let's go with Kevin Plawecki for a moment. I'm glad you obviously had to bring him up, right, because with Arno on the shelf, Plawecki's going to get most of the time. And I have to tell you, Mike, I really don't know what to think of Plawecki. I'll tell you some very top-line observations and you know, non-scientific visual observations. I think he's a better defensive catcher than d'Arnaud, although Travis, you know, threw some runners out early on this season, but he really has lapsed back into his bad habits of not being able to throw anyone out. And, yes, that could be a function of the pitchers. We understand that. But I do think Plawecki, if I had to put Darno and Plawecki side by side, I'd say Plawecki's the better defensively. He might be average, just slightly above, and Darno, I think, is slightly below average. Offensively, you know, that's supposed to be Darno's game, and you know, Darno hit fairly well last year, I think, in just statistically under half a season. I think he had 12 home runs or so, so you project that out, maybe 28 or so over the course of full season, and that's pretty good. But what are your thoughts on them? I mean, do you think that Plawecki is a serious downgrade from Darno, or do you think the jury's still out on Plawecki? What's your observation?
I think the jury's still out on both players, if you're asking me. Plawecki's interesting because, you know, you look at Michael Conforto, both of them were drafted out of college. You know, so you'd expect just a tad bit more polish out of them than you would a high school player. And then you look at what Conforto has accomplished thus far. And then you look at Plawecki and you think, well, you know, this guy's cut out of the same college mold, you know, so to say. Why is he lagging? And the answer is we just don't know. We don't know why his progress is lagging, per se. So, you know, Darno, he's not going to be able to establish anything until he has a full season under his belt. And obviously it's not going to happen this year again. Even if he misses, a minimal of games. But Plawecki, again, this is an opportunity. And actually, at what point does patience start running out on both?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a fair observation, Mike, because if I had to pick, you know, a lot of people were saying before the season began that if the team was going to have an Achilles heel, it would be the bullpen, particularly middle relief. I never bought into that. I thought, yeah, maybe some of these guys were unproven, but you have a guy like Robles who throws aspirin tablets up there. I thought they had a lot of potential. I was concerned behind the dish. Because I agree with you. You know, a lot of people were ready to say Darno is a very good major league catcher and he's going to, you know, hold the position down for years. I was never prepared to say that. You know, he had a lot of defensive deficiencies, and it's clear that the book on the Mets when you're playing the Mets is run on them as much as you possibly can because Darno can't throw you out. Offensively, he seemed to me to be streaky. Which is not the worst thing in the world. I mean, he could carry a team for a couple days or a week, but you would like to see a little bit more consistency there. But let's talk about Darno just for another moment. Like you said before, it's kind of a freak injury with a rotator cuff for a catcher. You know, we know Matt Wieters went down to needing Tommy John, but I haven't heard of too many catchers with rotator cuff issues. This is not a jammed thumb. A rotator cuff's a pretty serious thing. And I don't know, so what is your, obviously we're not doctors and we've never examined Travis Darno, but what is your gut on that? Do you think he does 15 days, you know, and it's like a strain and he's fine, or do you think this could be pointing to something more serious?
Oh, as far as the shoulder itself, you know, who knows? Who knows with the Mets, Rich? You know, one day it's this, the next day it's that. We've seen, you know, the most benign things just explode on them. So, you know, time will tell on that. But you're right. This is such an odd injury for a catcher. And I was talking to my cousin. We talk baseball all the time. And he's a catcher by nature as well. He says it's all in the footwork. It's all in the torque. It's all in your lower body. And when that goes awry, obviously you're throwing your arm, your shoulder, going to overcompensate. So, you know, he believes the problem stems from the toes up. If that answers your questions, I don't know.
It's a great point, though, and I never thought of that till this very minute, that with Darno's, shall we say, less than Fred Astaire-esque footwork behind the plate and, you know, forcing him to make throws from awkward positions, and I never really thought about that until you just said it. But maybe that, having to throw from those positions, is contributing to this rotator cuff issue. It seems that it happened when he swung the bat, but it had to be weakened somehow, right? And yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe that is it.
All right. Rich, being that I have control of the mothership and you're our leader tonight by voice, let's bring in Mike in Long Island. who's been a frequent caller of the show lately. Mike, hello.
Hello.
Hey,
and,
Mike, how are you?
Good, you?
Good, good. And you know, Mike, and I actually have the board myself, and so let's do something
okay,
a little creative.
Very good.
We have Mike on the line, and we have a 516 caller I'm going to bring on right now. So I'm not sure who this is. So 516 caller, who do we have?
It's Gary Mack. I just got Michael's email, and I'm sorry I'm late.
No,
hey, Gary.
Not at all. Not at all, friend.
How you doing, Gary?
I'm doing great, guys. I was just listening to the conversation about Darno, and I'd like to chime in and just say that your cousin, Michael, is 100% correct. A lot of it comes from the leg, and it could put an extra strain on your rotated cuff. And don't forget, he crashed into the stands the other day, and he's just a wild swinger when he swings sometimes at that bat, so that could all add up to it. But it's they've either got to find him a different position or move him, I think.
Yeah, you know, Gary, again, like we talked about a little bit earlier, I think some Met fans were very sold on Darno. I think a lot were not. I would be in the category that of people that were not. And you know, maybe find another position on the field, but, you know, I'm not a big fan of that. I'm not a big fan of teaching somebody another position on the major league level. You guys remember, I know Long Island Mike, I'll get to you in a moment, but you'll never remember this guy because he played before you were born, but Ron Gant is the example I use. You guys remember Ron Gant?
Yes. Atlanta
Ron
Braves.
Gant, right, Atlanta Braves. Good guy, good athlete, good ball player. The Braves asked him to learn a new position. I believe they wanted him to learn second base from the outfield. And what Gant did, I'll never forget this, he told the organization, okay, I'll do it, but send me to AA. Now, this guy had been in the major leagues for a couple of years. And he said, send me to AA. I want to learn that position in the minor leagues so when I'm back, I'm playing it competently. Okay, fine. Not many guys are going to do that. My concern with making Darno, what are you going to make him? We have a good situation at first base. You have Duda. You have Dominic Smith in the wings. Nobody's taking over for David Wright at third. And please, God in heaven, do not put a catcher in the outfield. We saw that with Hundley. And my God, I'll light candles in church and not make that one happen. I don't want to watch that. So this concept of, you know, making him play another position, not sure I like that. And I'm not sure his bat justifies it. You know, this guy isn't George Foster in the early 80s knocking 52 home runs. I mean, this guy, he's a decent stick, but he's not the kind of guy that you absolutely have to have in your lineup. So, I don't know. Long Island Mike, we haven't gotten to you yet. You usually have very strong opinions. So what do you think of Darno?
He's okay. He helps out the pitchers a lot. He's good at framing pitches compared to normal catchers. I've read a statistic where he's, like, way above average to frame pitches. So he helps out the pitchers. That's the only bright side to him I see in him. Kevin Pelletier, or however you pronounce his last name, I just don't like him. I don't see what people saw in him. Get rid of him. That's what I would like to say.
So you'd like to get rid of him and Matt Harper together, basically, right?
Yeah.
Mike, I just wanted to say we enjoy having you on the show because we're allowing you to be the voice of a younger generation because you're on the line with three old guys. Just want you to know that. Okay, so you know the way you hit home, you know, is refreshing, and you know, when you get old, you try to over rationalize and use cute words to get your way around situations. But, you know, just simply saying somebody sucks, sometimes that's refreshing.
And get rid of him, too. I like when he says that. He says, get rid of him.
Just get rid of him.
So, Plawecki, you know, and Gary, you know, please jump in on this one, but Plawecki, to me, you don't like to have a young guy be a bench piece in general, but Plawecki, and, you know, to my two colleagues of my two contemporary and age colleagues, when we grew up watching baseball, your backup catcher, wasn't it kind of Plawecki? A guy who, maybe he's a 220 hitter, maybe he can knock the ball out of the ballpark on occasion, decent defensively, but isn't Plawecki the mold of the Duffy Dyers of the world, in your opinion?
I don't know. I think he might be a tad better than that. I think he can hit better than he has. I think he's a far superior catcher defensively to Darnell. Look, he did something the other night that we hardly ever see. He threw out a base runner. So I think he's called a good game. The pitchers seem to like throwing to him. I just think there is some upside to him, and I think he will hit. He hit throughout the minors pretty well, and I think he'll hit here. I really believe that he got thrown into the job, and they probably told him to concentrate on the defense. The defense, and let the offense slide. Don't worry about the offense. And honestly, they really, if you think about it, especially us older guys, you know, Jerry Grody was never a great hitter. He was a great situational hitter and a clutch hitter. But he only hit 242, 250, 260, something in that range. He hit eighth a lot. Duffy Dyer was more of a power guy than Grody was. But, again, he was backup, as you said, Rich. I don't know. I think Plawecki can be a number one catcher somewhere. And I think part of the problem with the Mets was last year they should have had a veteran like a Henry Blanco or somebody of that ilk here to work with these two young guys and to help them along.
To jump all over that one, Mr. Mack, you know, for two years standing, or maybe even 3 years now, I've been wanting the Mets to sign, you know, A.J. Pierzynski. I think I wrote that 2 years ago, and I wrote it again last year, just for that reason that you stated. And I'll just throw another name out there. You know, it seems to me that Darnell has a lot in common with John Stearns. If it wasn't for bad luck, they'd have no luck at all.
Yeah.
Two ball
yeah.
players that just cannot avoid injury. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, and Darnell, again, I read something tonight, and I honestly don't remember the source. It said Darno's time in New York might be coming to an end. Maybe that is a function of simple frustration with him and the inability to keep him on the field. So I think basically what we've spent the last 20 minutes talking about is things are going well in Metville, and when you're picking on, you know, the catching spot, it is an important spot. That's a pretty good sign. You know, things aren't falling apart all over. We have one basic concern on the ball club, and that being the catching spot. Now, I wanted to move to something else and get you guys to react to it. Just go down the line. I'll start with you, Mike. The other night, we saw something that, I don't know, my first question to you guys is going to be, do you believe in sort of like fate or something like that? Because the other night what we were watching was a very lethargic Met team on Tuesday night with Bartolo Colon on the mound, and Colon was his typical self. He was effective, not great. Mets are down, you know, 3-0, and it kind of looked like one of those you can't win them all games. Okay, you're going to lose, big deal, right? But then something happened. Yoenis Cespedes comes up, kind of in his Kirk Gibson moment, kind of hobbles to the plate. First pitch, hits an absolute seed over the wall, and, you know, ties the game for the Mets, and the Mets go on to win. So my question to you, Mike, is do you think moments like that just happen, or do you think that moments like that are part of a bigger picture? Like, in other words, when you see things like that happening, do you start to get the feeling that this is a special Mets team and maybe something special can happen? Why don't you go with that one, Mike?
Oh, that's so difficult. I know exactly what you mean. First and foremost, you have to keep things in context. You know, I mean, if we were talking about the 99 team, we would be saying perhaps this is a moment that ignited them, you know, to a more elevated level of play. If we're talking about, say, the 86 team, yeah, that was the moment right there that everything, all the switches came on. And from that moment forward, they dominated. So I think we have to keep this in context. Now, what is that context? We're the defending National League champions. Well, first and foremost, we're talking about Cespedes. This is why we gave him the this is why ownership gave him the money, and Sandy Alderson, you know, recommended that they do so. This is why you put up with the idiosyncrasies that come along with Cespedes, because he's a game changer and he can change the nature of a game. He can change the emotional state of a team. He can change the outlook of an entire homestand, if not the month, et cetera, with one swing of the bat. So there's many things that you have to put up with, but the rewards are self-evident, you know, with that one swing of a bat. This season, it can be one of those moments. Obviously, it's going to be a moment we're going to be referring back to for a while. Yeah, remember back in April, Cespedes came up pinch hitter, whack, off the wall. Who knows if there's going to be a moment to top it, say, next month. We don't. So, again, let's just keep it in context. I know exactly what you mean, and I have that feeling. I'm just not willing, I'm just not willing to commit myself to saying that, I'm trying to stay a little bit more reserved, you know. That's all. I'm just trying to stay reserved about it, but I'm dying to go there, you know.
Yeah, and I get what you're saying. I totally get what you're saying, that, and that's the rational approach, is that it's only, look, that moment happened on April 26th. You know, which is not even a month or a 6-month season. And I completely understand what you're saying. I'll tell you what, though. Last year, the moment for me came almost a year to the day from the Cespedes home run. Daniel Murphy, the Mets were losing 1-0 in Miami, if you recall this year. Top of the 9th inning. It was about to be one of the fastest games in recent memory. It was going to be less than 2 hours because the Mets had no offense. Murphy came up in the top of the 9th and hit a 3-run home run. And I said to myself, sure, there are going to be a lot of ups and downs the rest of the way, and my God, there were. But you kind of had the feeling that maybe the cards were stacked in the Mets' favor. Maybe. And I completely agree that you're taking the very rational approach. But I want to run that by Gary and then Long Island Mike. So, Gary, do you believe in that stuff, or is it, you know, just one moment and let's file it away?
Well, I believe in it a little bit, but I say I happen to be at that game as well on Tuesday night, and I have to say that it did. It had the feel of one of those games. Well, you know, you're going to win 60 or lose 60, and it's what we do with the other 42. It felt like it was going to be a loss, and when he came up, it made the place electric. But I think what it does for a team is that it doesn't necessarily, turns the corner, but it gives them something to build on. It gives them the fact that, we can win any game that we're behind in because we can always come back. And that's something to have with a youngish team, is to have that kind of energy and that belief system. And, sometimes that's what you need just to carry you through. And I think that's the kind of game that was. That was the type of game to really build off of and to move on with.
Yeah, and right. Maybe it's not incredibly big, and maybe it's not, a blinking neon sign that this is the Mets year, but you're right. Maybe it's something that helps psychologically, and it's something to build with. So let's get a young man's view. So Long Island Mike, what were you thinking when Cespedes hit the home run?
I didn't think that was getting out, honestly, because I kept thinking of the old dimensions, like, that's not getting out of here. Then I remembered it's about the orange line. I'm like, wow, you're the real deal, Cespedes, even though he proved that last season. But that was just a bit of a shocker for me. We had no offense, Cespedes pitches, and what do you know, he hits a home run, ties the game up, then David Wright comes up in, hits a single or something, or a double, and scores the game-winning run, basically. And so, yeah, miracles can happen, but I think this is, we'll get used to seeing this a lot.
Yeah, it was a fun night, you know, and really what it told me is there might be more fun nights ahead. And that's a great thing. And I like, Gary, what you said, too, that the fact that this team, I've never been a fan of basing your offense on the long ball exclusively, which this team clearly does. But what this team is right now, they're never out of a game. And you have to like that as a fan. I mean, you really do. And they shouldn't be in a situation where they're down a lot of runs too often because the pitching has been so darn good. The starting pitching has been really good. But I do want to talk about one guy, and a guy who was near and dear to Long Island Mike's heart. Well, let's talk about Matt Harvey a little bit. So, Mike LeCollin, we'll go to you first on this one. So, Harvey, you know, started out with an 0-3 record, and then his game in Atlanta was, you know, like Ronnie said last night, a small step in the right direction. But then the game last night was a big step in the right direction. So, Mike, what are you seeing from Harvey, and do you think that, hey, it's just a situation where he got off to a slow start, everybody's human, Seaver was human, and he's going to be fine, or do you think maybe Matt Harvey isn't the guy that we thought he was in 2013? What are your thoughts at this point?
You know, it's actually becoming very easy to start picking on Matt Harvey for you know, his own reasons. But I guess you just got me on a good night. I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt insofar that he's a creature of habit and he feeds off of regularity. And it's now that point in the season. We have a month under our belt, and the rotation is starting to get into, you know, its standard form. So I'm hoping that that's the trigger mechanism that inspired Matt Harvey to a better start his last time out and, you know, that he'll continue to improve from this moment forward. I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, but we've already introduced overrated into the conversation. We have already introduced, you know, his conceit, you know, his level of conceitiveness. We've already introduced a couple of things that, you know, aren't so kind in conversation. So he's out there, he's exposed. So the Dark Knight just ultimately has to come through and perform.
Yeah, you know, I think that's it. You know, I think you're right. He set a very high level of expectation for himself. The fans have done some of it, you know, by saying this guy's a Dark Knight and all that stuff, but he's added to it. And now he has to go out there and perform, and three games did not a season make. And he could very easily end up, you know, 18-6, and he'll be back in our good graces. So Gary, what are your thoughts on Harvey? Do you think that maybe this guy is, you know, heaven forbid, a number two or number three starter, or do you think we just have to give him a little more time and let him and recognize that he's coming off Tommy John, you know, about 20 months ago?
Well, I think he's looked more like Robin than Batman, but I don't think he threw enough in spring training. I think they pampered him too much in spring training. I understand why, but I just think they didn't get enough work. And I think, as Mike was saying, I think, you know, that's showing now. It's showing some rut. I do have some concerns about Harvey. I think sometimes he reads his press clippings and believes them. And sometimes I wonder if he's so worried about this big contract. And, you know, he's got to go out and win 18, 19, 20 games if he's going to get this big contract. He can't continue to win 10, 12 games and then expect to get $30 million a year. He's got to be like a Kershaw. He's got to turn the corner somewhere. Now, I understand it's probably fundies, as Keith Hernandez says, that's throwing him off right now in the mechanics of his windup and everything. But he's got to straighten it out. But I'm like Michael. I'll give him a chance. I still think he can be the ace. But you know what? I really think the ace of the staff now is Syndergaard and DeGrom, and I think Harvey, if you had to number them, I think he'd be sitting at number three right now.
Oh, I think you're right. I think for sure at this point he's number three. And
let me ask you this. Do you think Mets fans, or you know, a majority or less than majority of Mets fans, have come to grips that he'll eventually be the first to go?
Yes.
Yes, I think so.
I think there's no
depending.
Question. Yeah.
Depending on what they get back.
And the key is going to be that they can't hold on to him too long. If you don't want to trade him in his walk year, in it be, obviously, because the value you'll get back will be nothing. So I think let's hope he goes 18-6 this year, and then they turn him into something really good in the off season. That's my hope. And now Long Island Mike, you know, you haven't had a chance to comment on Matt Harvey, so I'm kind of afraid to give the floor to you. That go ahead.
You know how I feel about Matt Harvey. I don't like his attitude or anything. He used to be good. I didn't like him last year. There was something off about him. He's not good this year. In general, he just sucks. I said we could have traded him last offseason to get someone good back, but now he's going to have an off year with like a 70 ERA, and we're going to get trashy players back if we trade for him. So Sandy Alderson's fault for not trading him last offseason, and fans will be screaming at him.
But I think the 7 ERA might be a little overstated. Yeah. I mean,
I don't think so. he's gonna turn into another CC Sabathia. Be good 1 year, then be horrible.
Wow.
I would have loved to have had Long Island Mike on a podcast about 35 years ago when Seaver was on the mound. If Seaver had a bad but
well, you know what, Rich? Dick Young did it, so.
Yes, Dick Young was not a fan. That is so true. And Mike, I'm sure you've heard of this, but Dick Young was a writer for the Daily News, and he used to rip Tom Seaver of being selfish. And basically, a lot of the things you're saying about Harvey, he used to say Seaver was a right?
It's true.
Small pocket of fans who actually believe Dick Young instead of Seaver turned against Seaver. And a lot of people feel that Dick Young started to turn the sentiment of the Met fans against Seaver, which gave the organization that much more reason to trade him. I don't buy that at all, but some people believe it.
Rich, that's your next post, man.
Yeah, there you go. Comparing Harvey to Seaver. I like it. All right, guys. So, you know, let's go to something else and keep with the pitching staff. Terry Collins, and I have been so down on him since game five. I'm kind of sometimes I shock myself with how down I am on this guy, but I have to say he did something I really liked last night, and I want you guys to comment on this. Gary, we'll start with you on this one. So what I liked was he had Addison Reed close the game. Here you had a situation where Familia had pitched 3 days in a row, and I am a big believer that if you expect these guys to go into October and into November, you have to start treating them like assets and using them appropriately. I am not a fan of abusing your closer. I've never been a fan of using the closer, oh, okay, we're getting killed tonight, let's let him work an inning just to get work. I've never believed in that, because the very next night you might need six outs out of that closer, or you might need him the next 3 days in a row. So I think that the closer or anybody else only has so many pitches a season in the arm, and I've never been a fan of wasting them. So last night, I'm sitting here saying to myself, look, this is a struggling Reds team. The offense isn't very good. Familia's pitched 3 days in a row. Let Addison close this game, Terry. And lo and behold, he did it. And I was thrilled that he kept Familia in the pen, giving him last night off and, of course, tonight off. So, Gary, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, because, you know, Ronnie didn't agree. Last night, Ronnie said, Familia's pitching well. You have to go to your horse here. And I did not agree with that. So, Gary, where do you come out on that?
Well, I agree with you, Rich. I think he did a smart move in doing that. And, you know, don't forget, they're going to have that, 17 games now without a day off. So that's going to be a big streak. I'm sure he's going to have to be used somewhere in those games. and he's got to see what else he has there, who else can close in case, God forbid, anything happens to anybody, familiar or otherwise. And if you also notice, he used Robles, I think, in the eighth last night. So showing some confidence in the young man. And, I think it was a good move. And I think he's feeling his bullpen out. He's trying to see what he's got, who he can use in what situations. Can he mix and match? Can he shuffle these guys around? And so far, I think it's working. I think he's got them exactly where he's happy with who he's putting in situations. And they're coming through so far.
Yeah. No, they are. And I like – well, I'm not going to say I like his use of the bullpen so far this season, because I don't. I think I like his use of the bullpen last night. So, so Mike LeCollin, what do you think of that? Are you – where do you come down? Do you come down on the side of Ronnie, use your guy here, or were you happy to see Familia get a couple days off?
Rich, I'm drunk off of your Kool-Aid, man. I'm so with you and your point. No, really. I mean, Addison Reed, he's the hot hand right now. He's been having a fantastic start to his season. And you know, you can't abuse Familia so early in the season. He's been hittable all month, although he's snapping out of it. But like you said, Rich, he had been used, repeatedly over the previous couple of games. But, you know, a bullpen is just like a batting lineup. You're only as good as the guy hitting behind you. And guys like Logan Verrett and Jim Henderson have made that possible, you know, that Reed can step into a closer's role every so often. You know, so Terry Collins is dealing with a little bit more depth and reliability right now, more so than he has had, you know, previously.
Yeah. No, I agree with that, actually. That bullpen is deep. It's deep and it's young for the most part, with the exception of Henderson. So, all right, Long Island Mike, what were you thinking last night when you let Reed close it?
If you follow my Twitter account, I was going off saying they should be able to pitch every day of the year if they needed to. They're being paid millions of dollars, and they can't pitch goddamn three innings. Not three innings, one inning. Are you kidding me?
You should have been born in the 70s, man.
I'm a pitcher. I can go out every day if I wanted to. Well, until I found out I'm a ticking time bomb for Tommy John, but that's another story. But, yeah, they're paid out millions, or the league minimum. I'm not sure how much he's making. He should be able to go out there every day if he wanted to, if he needed to, I should say, and just go out and pitch and do fine. That's how I see it.
You sound like an old, grizzled, angry guy.
Wow, that's tough.
He's older than us. I mean, he's not older than us. He sounds like he's older and angrier than we are. We're pretty old and angry. Anyway, all right, so I want to go to something else. And, all right, Mike LeCollin, we'll start with you here. So, Mike, we're going to play the Rising Op Report version of Guess That Met, and this is going to be easy, so I promise. All right, I'm going to tell you, I'm describing a Met who has 9 home runs in April.
Oh, that's easy.
Runs batted in, and a .300 batting average. Mike, who am I talking about?
Well, it's certainly not Daniel Murphy. He's the guy
Daniel Murphy.
Yeah, it's the guy who made us forget who Daniel Murphy is.
All right, so right.
How
it's
about
Neil
that, huh?
I like that a lot. Yes, that was well done. So, Mike, it's Neil Walker, and I'm going to ask you 2 questions about Neil Walker, and same 2 for everybody. What is your level of surprise at the production the Mets are getting out of Neil Walker? And is it starting to come into your mind that maybe the plan has to be altered? And let's say that the plan was to use Neil Walker for one full season and then let him go his merry way as a free agent and bring up Dilson Herrera. So how surprised are you at what the Mets are getting? And are you starting to think maybe this guy needs to be here a little longer than one season? What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, just based on what he did this month, he poses an interesting problem now. Because the plan was just that. You know, he was supposed to be a transient player until we got Dilson Herrera, you know, up to snuff for the major league level.
Interesting. You know, I'm a stickler, you know, stick with the plan. And I applauded Sandy Alderson throughout the rebuilding years that he was adamant about, you know, what he was doing, and he did so with conviction, and he stuck with the plan, and he didn't deviate. So here I am, and I'm pondering, you know, keeping this guy for an additional year, if he'll agree to it, I don't know. But, you know, he's hot, and baseball is a game of averages. You know, and he just happens to be doing very well right now. Like I say, you flip a coin 50 times, you might very well flip it heads 9 times in a row very easily. And then you might have a stretch where you go 7 times and you get tails, and it skips by 1 and 5 more times you get tails again. So baseball is a game of averages. We have to figure that one out on the tail end of this. The plan is still in place, I think, you know, because money-wise, you know, the Mets still have escalating arbitration figures to deal with. So money-wise, he may not fit in the plan anyway, regardless of what we want to think or desire. So maybe Gilson Herrera is our future, and this guy's going to be a one-hit wonder for us.
Okay, and I know you, and Mike, kudos to you, because you've always said that. You know, you've always said that the key is to have a plan and stick to the plan, and you're staying with that now, though you're leaving the door open for a potential reevaluation. I think that's fair, because, like you said, it's a game of averages. We're not even one full calendar month into the season just yet. And, you know, it's probably a little too early to scrap the plan and say we have to keep Walker, but and he will cost money. But, you know, it's something that you keep the door open to. So, Gary, where do you come down on that?
I go along with you guys it's early. Let's see what he does the rest of the year. But it has been an amazing trade when you consider that all we gave up with Jonathan Neese for this. I mean, this is unbelievable what he's doing. But let's wait and see. But I would be open to signing him. I would be happy if there would be a way to sign him and have Herrera somehow come up and learn from him. I know that's going to be impossible to do because it wouldn't work out bench wise, and he wouldn't get enough playing time. At his age, he should be playing, but that would be the almost perfect situation if he could learn from him. And you know, the thing I noticed also in this April is I don't cringe at a ball hit to a middle infielder anymore. I don't know. How about you guys?
You're right. They totally transformed the middle infield.
Well, he made an error last night.
Humans make errors. We're human beings. We're not robots. You can forgive an error. You just can't forgive certain things. Like playing that ground ball in the World Series. Excuse me. Sorry. I digress.
Oh, boy. So, all right, Long Island Mike. I think I know where you come down on this one, but go ahead. What do you think of Neil Walker, and would you contemplate or begin contemplating keeping him around?
Well, first off, when I go to the game this weekend, I know what shirt I'm buying. I'm going to buy a Neil Walker shirt. Second off, that's a tough question. Like you said, it's only the first month into the season, basically. This could just be a hot streak, or could this be the new him if he went to the Mets? That's the question. Well, I would leave the door open for reevaluation, like who else said that here? Because I'm watching the NFL draft right now. Who else said that? Yeah, but
I think we all did.
Okay. Yeah.
So,
we did.
Leave the door open for reevaluation. See what goes on the rest of the season, and if you have to, keep Neil Walker and put Gilson Herrera down in the minors one more year. He's only 22 years old. He's got time.
So I think we're unanimous. I think it's a little too early to, you know, start erecting statues to Neil Walker, but let's just say he ends up with, you know, 33 home runs, which is amazing for a second baseman. He's well on the pace to do much more than that. Let's say it's 30 home runs. Right now he's hitting an even 300. He is hitting, an even 300. And let's say he hits 280. It would be something worth thinking about. And as a switch hitter, let's not underestimate that. I mean, as a switch hitter, he gives the Mets lineup flexibility. So it's something worth keeping the eye on, and if the plan has to be altered, then so be it. You know, you guys mentioned Asdrubal Cabrera, because you said that the defense up the middle has been entirely revamped. And let's not lose sight of the fact that Cabrera is hitting 301. We have Walker hitting 300, Cabrera hitting 301. Cabrera is certainly not hitting for the power, but he has shown himself to be a very steady, very reliable shortstop, if not a spectacular one, a very steady, very reliable one. And I'm willing to eat crow on that, because I did not want Asdrubal Cabrera anywhere near this team. I thought his shortstop days were over. But based on his offense and his steady defense, I'm good. I'm happy to have him. Go ahead.
Can I say something?
Sure.
I completely disagree with what you just said, because when we got him, I was cheering and everything. I was cheering because I'm like, yes, no more Wilma Flores, thank God. I hated Wilma Flores. Even after the crying days, I hated him. Hated with a capital H.
Don't hold back. Say what you feel, man.
He just creates too many errors in the field. Yes, he has some pop in his bat, but who cares? Daniel Murphy, Wilma Flores did not make a good combo. Wilma Flores was the main idea. If it was my choice to whose leg to be broken, I wish it was Wilma Flores instead of Ruben Tejadas.
Wow, that's brutal. But you know what? We have our next topic of conversation. Gentlemen, we saw Wilma Flores at first base, and it wasn't pretty. What are we going to do with Wilma Flores?
Go with that, Mike. I wanted to get to that, because Wilma Flores, it's not pretty, folks. He's hitting .083. Ooh, that's ugly. Mike LeCullen, go with that.
Well, you know, I'll just repeat myself. You know, we saw him at first base. That was the plan, for him to be the backup first baseman. And, you know, he actually looks pretty or fairly comfortable at third sometimes. But, I mean, the writing's on the wall. What do we do with Wilma Flores? He's turning into a, you know, square peg in a round hole. He's starting to really not fit in here. Before, you know, necessity is the mother of all invention, but with Cabrera and Walker, we're finding less of a need for him. He would have been interesting off the bench this season. Maybe, you know, like we say, this is only 1 month into this. Maybe Flores will snap out of it. He, after all, he had, with the bat at least, a brilliant minor league career. We just don't know what to do with him in the field, and we saw him at first base, and, oh, boy, we didn't like what we saw, did we?
No, we didn't. And I wonder, you know, going forward, if that's something that the Mets need to address the trade deadline, because right now, you know, backup middle infielder, your backup middle infielder pretty much is Wilmer Flores. And is that what you want? You know, maybe he's not suited to the role. And I like what you said. Maybe he is a round peg in a square hole. And that might be the piece the Mets need to grab at the trade deadline, is maybe go out and grab somebody's veteran middle infielder who can sit on the bench, come off and give you reliable defense here and there, and, you know, maybe steal a base, maybe knock him off the ballpark, whichever. But I don't know. We may have uncovered a little bit of a need for this team, because I'm not loving the concept of Flores either as the backup middle infielder. I don't know. Gary, what do you think of that?
Don't we still have Danny Muno?
Oh, boy.
We're in trouble.
Wait, he's still on this team?
He's in the minors, yeah.
I think he's in the minors.
Why?
Because they needed a filler at Tidewater, obviously. And he was the guy that they used. He knows somebody. He's got dirt on somebody. But he's been okay in the minors. So, you know, the interesting, though, if I could go back a second just to Walker, the situation, I know we all want to see Herrera, but if Herrera was used as trade bait, you know, they're very strong in the minors, second base. L.J. Mazzilli is at Binghamton. They have Vinny Siena is at Columbia, a couple of years away, but they could conceivably go with a walker for a couple of years to try to bridge to one of those guys if they feel he can still play and if they could use Herrera to get another piece back. As far as Flores goes, he's like a man without a country. I mean, he just doesn't have a position. I wasn't too upset about his first base play. He's handled the routine plays. He made a couple of bonehead plays, but that's a lot of that's experience. And I kind of feel bad for the guy because it's tough to get your rhythm in hitting if you're sitting on the bench that much. And it's a tough job. Not everybody can do it. And he's a young guy. He's going to have to learn how to do it. But I don't know. Where do you play the guy? I mean, you got Matt Reynolds down there that can play the middle infield if you put Flores in a trade. And if you didn't bring back a veteran or a youngish guy, you could use Matt Reynolds. So I just don't know what the future holds for Flores.
Yeah. You know, I think we know where Long Island Mike comes down on Flores. So, but the thing is, with Flores, it's just they've been trying to jam this guy into different spots for years, and it just doesn't seem to work. And maybe you're onto something. Maybe Flores needs to go eventually. Last time he got out of it, but maybe he does need to go. And maybe there's a package that can be made with, Flores and Herrera. Maybe somebody would like to take a shot at a couple of young middle infielders and get something back. But it just doesn't seem like he's suited to this particular role. He certainly wasn't suited to being a starting shortstop. I agree with the fact that he is probably best suited at third base, but I don't think that's happening in the near future. So he does look like a man without a country, to use a term that Gary used, I just think, or maybe it was Mike. I'm just not sure that he fits on this team. And rather than continually pounding your head against the wall and trying to say this guy is something that he isn't, maybe it is time to cut bait with this guy. And I believe I wrote about this in a Rising Apple in our season preview, that I think the thing that they'll do with the deadline is look for a quality middle infielder and look to grab somebody who has 2 months left on his contract just to plug that hole. So we'll see. We'll see, but it certainly doesn't appear to be Flores. And we couldn't do a podcast about the Mets and talk about all the positive stuff without talking about Michael Conforto. Here's another example, guys, where I have to eat some crow on this one. I was not a fan of bringing him up. I thought that they rushed him to the major leagues. He did not have enough time in the minors. And my God, was I wrong, because right now, right? I mean, listen to these numbers. They're gaudy. 338 average, 429 on base percentage, slugging percentage of 615, which gives him an OPS of 1.044. That's sick. Three home runs, 13 RBIs, and I'll tell you what, as if this Sunday needed a cherry, the guy can play a good left field. He's probably not going to be a gold glover, but he gets to a lot of balls. Seems like he gets good reads and good jumps and takes good angles. His throws are accurate. So here's my question to you, Gary. Are we looking at a potential Keith Hernandez here, at least offensively, or do you think the jury's still way out on this guy, or are you seeing the potential for stardom in this kid?
I'm seeing the stardom in this kid, and I saw him in Brooklyn, and I knew he was going to hit. The ball just sounds different coming off his bat. I can't explain it, but there's a different sound when the ball hits his bat. And he's a smart kid. And don't forget, he's a college kid. So he's going to come into his power a little quicker than some, like a Nimmo or some of these other guys, because they were high school kids and they're growing into their bodies now. He's already done a lot of that. He's done a lot of the maturing with that. So I think we're looking at something really, really special. And, you mentioned his fielding, and if I may, I interviewed Tom Gamboa, the manager of the Cyclones, a couple of years ago, and that was one of the things that he was shocked at, because he had this scouting report that he was a bad to average fielder. And he was terrific in the Penn League a couple of years ago. And Gamboa asked him, how did he get this rap? And he said that he came up as a shortstop. He played shortstop in high school. And when he went to college, they moved him to the outfield. And he probably didn't work as hard as he should have because he could hit like crazy, so he was in the lineup. But he's been working on his field, and he's a terrific outfielder. He's a solid outfielder, let's put it that way. He gets to what he can get to, and he always throws to the right base. His throws are accurate, doesn't have the greatest arm in the world, but he's accurate, he's quick to the ball, and boy, can he hit.
He can. I mean, you look at his swing, you know, and to me it's very Keith Hernandez-like.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's quiet, it's consistent, it's level, it's all those things. So, yeah, as much as, you know, it's very early, and we've, you know, that seems to be a theme in this podcast, but as much as it's very early for Conforto, it certainly looks like the Mets could have a real gem on their hands. And Mike Lecolin, what are you seeing with Conforto?
Conforto mania is running wild. He's just picking up where he left off last season. And of all the things mentioned, you know, I'm most impressed with his 9 doubles, because it tells me he's not trying to hit home runs. He's just trying to make solid contact. And then he's doing just that, you know. I love a doubles hitter because ultimately, with a little bit of seasoning and understanding of your craft at the plate, you know, home runs will come. Home runs get hit when you're not trying to hit them. So, you know, to me, that's a very promising figure right there, 9 doubles. And he leads the team, by the way, which is incredible. Conforto mania is running wild.
It is. All right, Long Island Mike. I don't think we've ever talked about Conforto. So where are you coming down on Conforto?
I just got my Conforto shirt because Modell's must have been listening to the show where I was, going off of Modell. So I got my Conforto shirt. I'm happy about that. But I love Conforto. Love him. When do we have him signed for? Do you know the year?
Yeah, he can't be a free agent. I could pull that up for you right now. But Conforto, I think last year he does get credit. So I think we have 5 full years with him. Let's take a look here. Let's see. First eligible free agent 2022.
Okay, so, yeah, we don't have to worry about that for a while. Just make sure it stays healthy. Don't become a David Wright and get spinal stenosis and stuff like that. And you'll be good.
Wow.
You'll be like here in New York.
I think he really has a chance to be something special. He
I
really
agree.
Does. Everything you see in this kid, there's nothing in his game. His intelligence is there. Where we talk defense, we talk offense. And if you look at some of the games he plays, you know, he'll hit a home run to right field, then he'll hit a double up the left center field gap. I mean, how much do you love watching that? A guy who can go the other way, who can pull the ball when he needs to, and then he'll make a good play and throw somebody out at second base trying to stretch a single into a double. There's just so much to like in this kid. And, yes, he will have his slumps for sure, and we'll have to deal with that. But it certainly looks like the Mets are on to something with this guy, and we'll see what his future holds.
I want to ask you a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Quick. Why are teams shifting on him?
You know what? Fantastic question. I don't have the answer because the guy demonstrates he can hit the ball to left center field. Why you would shift on this guy, and my daughter and I watch the games together all the time, and I always say to her, what are they doing shifting on this guy? Mike or Gary, do either one of you guys have a thought on that?
Oh, yeah, but it wouldn't be exactly PC, so I'll just keep it to myself.
Gary?
I don't understand why they do all this shifting anyway, so I don't understand it. I think it's just sometimes these managers want to get into the game or show that they're in the game, and they just move these guys around for the hell of it, but... I don't know. Now they shift on everybody, it seems, and it's crazy.
Did you hear what Joe Girardi said? He said if he was MLB commissioner, he would ban chist, and I completely agree with that.
It really, you know, for those of us, the older guys on the line, we watched baseball for all these years. The shift wasn't a thing. I guess they did it with Ted Williams, which predates all of us. But I used to have an uncle who, huge Yankee fan, hated Ted Williams, and he said they used to shift on Ted Williams, and he was so arrogant he tried to hit the ball through the shift instead of going the other way. But it was so much the exception then, and now it's so much the rule. And I'll tell you what. Another thing my daughter and I say all the time we watch the games, when Duda's up and they have the overdone shift on him, drop a damn bunt down the third baseline once in a while. Will you please? You know what I mean? Burn the shift once in a while. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Who's speaking?
If Big Poppy can do it, Lucas Duda can do it.
If he does that, make sure it's this weekend while I'm there. Because I would love to see how fast he runs.
But it doesn't have to. There's nobody there. Just drop the pitch here.
The pitch here.
Well, Long Island Mike, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, Joe Girardi said if he were commissioner, he would indeed ban the shift. It's funny because the Yankees shifted the third most times in the American League last season.
I know.
You know, but the thing is, that comes from Cashman. Cashman demands that he go by the numbers. He's one of those, you know, these modern statisticians and the sabermetrics and all that. And that's why, you know, there's a shift on Conforto. Because in this small sample size, that's what the model says to do. So, you know, before I really go off on a tangent, I'll just stop there.
Oh, and Sam.
You mean Rich?
No, Sam.
Sam's not on.
Wait, he isn't?
No.
Oh, God, I'm dumb.
We have
dumb right now.
Rich, Mike, and Gary.
I look like a complete idiot on air.
That's all right.
Hold on, let me send you a... hold on, man.
All right, so while we're doing that, I wanted to get to some more things on this podcast. And here's the first one. We're going to do number 31. You guys can start thinking about that. Think about Mets that stick out to you who have worn number 31. But before we get there, I'd like to talk about the upcoming series against the Giants. And here's what I want to talk about. You know, the Mets are doing well, and I'm not trying to throw cold water on this in any way, shape, or form. But they have been beating the crap out of some bad teams, let's be honest. So the Mets opened the season playing the World Series champions, and everybody they've played since has been an also-ran. You know, you can make an argument for the Indians, but the Phillies are in rebuilding mode. The Braves are in rebuilding mode. The Indians are okay. The Reds are god-awful. So, and the Mets are doing what they have to do. They're beating up on bad teams, and that's all well and good. But now the Giants come to town. You know, the Giants are, last time I checked, they were a little bit over 500, so they're good. I know it's the even year thing and all of that. So here's where I'm going with this. Do you view this early season series against the Giants as a bit of a test, given who the Mets have played thus far? Do you view it as a bit of a test, and are you going to be a little more dialed in to this series than you might otherwise be to a series on the last weekend of April? So why don't we start with Gary on this one? So, Gary, how do you feel about that?
Well, it'll be a little bit of a test, but I'm not going to be too concerned. They got swept last year, even got no hit by the Giants in that one series, and I think that was later in the year. So the year ended up pretty good. So I'm not that concerned. Look, you know, part of the job that you have as a team is to beat up on those lousy teams, and they're doing it. And you know, hope that you play 500 against the real good teams. And that's what you got to look for. So, you know, if they lose two, I would like to see them get at least one. Actually, I'd like to see them get three. But, you know, one and they drop two, as long as they're close games and they're not getting blown out, I think it'll be all right. It's still early in the season.
But I am. So maybe you're not. I'm looking at it like this. No, I mean, I'm not going to jump off a bridge if they lose 2 out of 3 or, God forbid, get swept, but it is going to be the first time they played a decent team since Kansas City. So, you know, I'm kind of curious, I'll say, to see how they play against the Giants, because the level of competition has been pretty bad since the opening couple games.
Yeah, well, so, you know, Philadelphia is not – they're an improved team, though, I think, from last year.
Yes, they are.
You know, they've got some offense there. They've got some good young players. Their problem right now is pitching and really the bullpen. But they're putting together something there. I think it's a couple of years away, but they're not that bad. But, no, I agree. They're playing at the bottom of the division. But those are the games you have to win and build your record on. And they've been doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the Yankees model. You know, when the Yankees were winning all those World Series, what they did was they just beat the living crap out of the teams they were supposed to beat. And that's – you don't apologize for that. That's what you're supposed to do. All right, Mike LeCullen, what do you think? Any extra intrigue playing the Giants after all the dregs of the National League have been running through Citi Field?
Yeah, if I could steal a word from Long Island Mike, the Phillies suck. You know, we should beat them.
No, the Phillies don't suck. The Phillies don't suck.
They do.
They're
no,
better
they
than
suck,
people
man.
Think.
All right, so
they
suck.
They're better than people think.
All right, having said that, Rich, I'm kind of with you. An old dude named Socrates said, man is the measure of all things. You know, so take that. And, you know, I have this belief that seasons – are like centipedes and that all games are interrelated in one form or another. So I want them to do well. And if they don't do well, then I want them to respond well, you know, and spring back from defeat. Or if they sweep, I want to see them continue this winning streak. You see, so every day just updates the narrative. So win, lose, or draw, it's going to give us, you know, our next point of contention. Or wonder, you know what I mean? So go in there and just try to beat the Giants. That's my objective. Beat whoever you're playing. You can only beat the team that's on the field with you at the moment. So, yeah, the Giants come, you know, replete with a reputation for being a two-time champion. So get ahead. Make the most of it. Beat them, you know. If you want, here's another saying from wrestling. You know, the great Ric Flair, if you want to be the man, you got to beat the man. You know, so I want to beat the best team out there. I want to have them at their best. I want them at their healthiest. And I want to see their ace. And I want their, you know, power guy in the lineup batting fourth. And you know, I want to beat teams at their best. That's just the way I see it.
How did we go from Socrates to Ric Flair? I don't know. Did I miss something?
Look, we're a full-service podcast here, Gary. You know, we just try to educate the masses as best we can. You know, so a little history lesson, Socrates, Ric Flair. You know how that goes, bro.
Yeah, okay.
We went from Greek philosopher to American philosopher.
Holy.
Woo!
So, Long Island Mike, what do you think? Which games are you going to, by the way, this weekend?
Saturday and Sunday.
All right, so what do you think? I mean, is it just 3 more games, or are you saying to yourself, geez, you know, okay, it's great, 13-7 against bad teams, but I want to say they do against a decent team, or is it just 3 more games to you?
Sunday is going to be a test. Bumgarner and Thor, that's going to be a game. It may get rained out, hopefully it doesn't, but that's going to be a game. But Sunday I would keep an eye on. The other two games are just 2 games.
All right, fair enough. All right, gentlemen, we are close to wrapping it up. This is episode number 131 of the Rising Apple Report. So consistent with what we do, we're going to take a look at Mets who have worn a number relevant to the number of the podcast. So nobody's ever worn 131. So we'll do Mets who have worn number 31. And, you know, there's one who jumps off the page. I'm not going to touch it because I'll let you guys do that.
But, yeah.
We all have a number 31 in our mind. Actually, there are 2 that jump off the page based on longevity with the number. But I'm going to go to one guy in this list, not one of the two obvious ones. I'm going to go to one, and we'll start with Gary again after me. So I'm going to go with Mike Vail. And the reason I'm going with Mike Vail is when Mike Vail came up, he kind of was like a right-handed hitting Conforto, right? An outfielder, not great speed, you know, average speed, average to maybe a little bit above average defender, but my God, could he hit. Sweet swing, you know, some power, line drive kind of hitter, and for the longest time he held the Mets record for most consecutive games with hit, you know, longest hitting streak. And then Mike Vail got hurt. Honestly, I don't exactly remember the injury. Maybe you guys do. But he got hurt, and he basically fell off the face of the earth. You know, he came back the following season, was a shell of himself, and was out of baseball within a year or two. And so Mike Vail was a guy, and I guess if you had to take a life lesson from Mike Vail, it would be tomorrow's not promised. It's just not. I mean, this guy looked for all the world like he was going to be the next, you know, consistent 300 hitter. Something happened, he got hurt, and he disappeared quickly. So good life lesson there from Mike Vail that, you know, for these guys on the field and for those of us fans, enjoy these guys while we have them because tomorrow's isn't guaranteed. So so we'll go to Gary next. So Gary, who jumps off the 31 list to you?
Well, I'm going to go completely different. And it's not going to be the guy that you think. I'm going to go with the first guy to wear the number, Larry Brdar. I remember this guy, blonde, big guy, pitcher, local kid. I think he was from Staten Island. Went to St. John's and played with just a horrible team. Ended up with a 13-21 record. But the first guy to wear the number, that's who jumped off me, and he died, unfortunately, at the age of 58, very young man. And but he's the guy I'm going to talk about that I jumped off to me.
All right, Larry Brdar. And I believe he was a pitching coach later in his career, right?
Yes, he was with Colorado and I think Montreal for a while.
Right. I remember him as a pitching coach. All right, Mike LeCollin, nobody's taking the obvious bait here, so where are you going on 31?
Well, I think we're all going to take a slice of the piazza pie and the Franco cannoli, so we'll save them for last. And I'm going to go with Ed Lynch. You know, he was one of those unheralded pitchers for the Mets during their rebuilding years. A very good pitcher for the Mets. And he was, you know, the Mets and Ed Lynch parted ways just as they turned the corner. He was with the Mets in 86 for a game. I feel so bad for the guy. If they didn't give him a ring, I don't know any better, but if they didn't give him a ring that year, it's a crime because he was a Met from 1980 through 1985. And then, like I said, he played one game for the Mets in 1986 and then, you know, goodbye. But he was a very good pitch. No, all right, he wasn't outstanding. Very serviceable pitcher in down years. He went 10-10 one year with a 4-and-change ERA. In 85 was a very good year for us, you know. And his 10-8 record and 3.44 ERA, I think, went underappreciated. And I would just like to give a shout-out to him. And like I said, I think we all have something to say about Piazza and Franco. So, you know, that's it, man. I'll take Ed Lynch.
Nice. All right, Long Island Mike, this is like the buffet. Everybody's gone through the line, and there's a lot of food left. Where are you going on the buffet line at 31?
I'm young. I don't really know a lot of guys on that list, so I have to go Mike Piazza.
Go for it, bro. Break the ice.
The Mets should have never sold his jersey to begin with. Why would they do that?
Guys, that's a very fair point. It's a major criticism, and it's fair.
Yeah. Second off, he was the best catcher ever, in my opinion. And that's really all I can say about him. There's not much you can disagree with Mike Piazza. There's really not.
No, there's not. And I'll tell you one thing. You know, people say he was bad defensively. He was bad at throwing runners out. That's true. But he called a good game. He was good on plays at the plate, good on foul pops, and, you know, and he was tough as nails back there. And if you're going to say that with all this guy did in his career, and he was good in other aspects defensively, and say, you know, he didn't throw a lot of runners out. I mean, are you kidding me? The guy's in the Hall of Fame for a reason. So I think if you're a Mets fan, I don't know one Mets fan who doesn't love Piazza. You just have to. I'm going to just open mic it for a moment. So, Mike, Gary, add comments on Piazza if you wish. Talk about the jersey if you wish. If you want to mention Franco, go with that. Open mic.
Mr. Mack, right. I defer to you.
what can you say? And he probably hit the penultimate home run in the history of the franchise with that shot on 9/11. So just a terrific player. And I agree about catching. He didn't have the best arm, and his footwork really tied him up a lot. But he could block pitches in the dirt, good at home plate, like you said, tag plays, and called a good game. Pitches like throwing to him, despite the deficiency. But I think he got a bad rap with that. And just a terrific hitter and a clutch hitter, and just so glad that he's going to the Hall of Fame as a Met.
Amen, brother. Mike LeCullen, here. You want to add anything on Piazza or Franco?
Yeah, here. I'm glad he's going in as a Met. You know, Piazza put up with a lot of crap from the media in this town. And he did it with class. He did it with dignity, you know. And I respect him for that. He never ducked a question. He was always accountable for himself. And, too much blame for not winning the World Series fell on his shoulders, which is entirely unfair. John Franco, I'm going to ask you guys, this way we can all participate on this. I wasn't here to see Randy Myers as a Met. Was John Franco better or was Randy Myers better? What's the deal with that trade?
Gary, you want to go first?
I was never a big Randall K. Myers fan. I think his days with the Mets, he was wild, if I remember correctly, and he was one of those guys, he'd walk three guys and then strike out three guys. So I think it just got to the point where Cincinnati wanted to dump Franco, and the Mets really wanted to get rid of Myers. I think they were just running out of stomach medicine at that time and wanted to get somebody else in here, and they knew it would be unpopular getting rid of Myers, and of course getting Franco, bringing Franco home is like almost the perfect trade to cover your butt. So I think that's what was behind it. As far as I can remember, though, Myers, New York, he really blossomed when he left here.
He did. No, he absolutely did. As a Met, Randy Myers was, I think Gary hit the nail on the head. He was a hard-throwing guy who had moments of looking incredibly dominant,
mm-hmm.
but also had moments of looking, he was like six-pack Stanhouse, You'd go through your Rolaids. But the Mets got Franco. Franco was clearly on the downside of his career when the Mets got him. And he hung around for a long time, and that's all well and good, but if you remember, he lost the closer's job in, 1998, I believe he lost the closer's job to, first to Mel Rojas and then to Armando Benitez.
Mm-hmm.
So, Franco is basically a guy who who was on his way to a record. He actually broke the record as a Met, most saves as a left-handed reliever. He had a great career at Cincinnati and was, like I said, on the downside, lost the closer's job. And, was a long-time Met, and okay. He did the role that they asked him to do, and the strikeout of Barry Bonds in the playoffs, we'll all remember that. That was his pinnacle moment as a Met, and it was a great moment. I mean, the Mets needed that. But he wasn't nearly the Met that he was a Red, if you know what I mean. He was a much better
mm-hmm.
Red than he was a Met. So So with all that said, gentlemen, I think we have turned
can
the
I
corner.
Ask,
go ahead.
Can I ask a question real quick?
Sure, of course.
So last year was Jacob DeGrom Garden Gnome Day. They were selling for $80 on eBay. As you know, Saturday is Cinder Garden Gnome Day. How much are they going to be selling for on eBay?
A lot.
Good question.
A lot.
A lot. Yeah.
More than DeGrom or?
I bet you you'll have people in the parking lot with a sign, $200 for your bobblehead.
I guarantee you people
I
just buy
that.
The tickets in the upper deck, last row, and be like, yes, free bobblehead, then just leave.
I mean that. Somebody's going to go there with $1,000 with the intention of trying to buy like 5 bobbleheads from people walking out, out of the gate.
And it's amazing, you know, if you're selling them on eBay, and I've never done that, but you could make a killing. I remember I was at Dodger Stadium about 5 years ago for a Met game, and it was Andre Ethier bobblehead night. Now, of course, I got a bobblehead, and I don't want the damn thing, right? So
just throw it back.
So, well, the guy next to me said, because I was wearing my Mets gear, he's like, so what are you doing with your Andre Ethier bobblehead? I'd imagine you don't want it. And I said, I do not. And he said, I will buy you beer for your bobblehead. I said, you're on, buddy. If he went and sold it on eBay to Dodger fans, he probably made $25. He spent $5 on my beer, probably made some money, you know. So anyway, gentlemen, we have officially turned the corner to what I'll call the bottom of the ninth inning, and it is time for the last word. So the last word is going to go in this order. We're going to go to Long Island Mike first for the last word. And then we're going to go to Gary, and then I'll let Mike LeColin take us home. So my last word for tonight is fun. And the reason I'm picking that one is right now watching New York Mets baseball is fun. And it's been fun since about August 1st of last year. So that's basically August, September, October, and then April of this year. For the last 4 months, watching New York Mets baseball has been a lot of fun, and we deserve that after 6 losing seasons. So, yes, we talked about Darno, and we talked about how Terry might mismanage the bullpen on occasion. All that said, our problems are pretty minimal as Mets fans. It's a lot of fun to watch this team, and let's keep it in that context. Enjoy it, because we know what, to use the term of the night, we know what suck feels like, and it doesn't suck now. It's fun, and let's just enjoy it. That's where I am. So, Long Island Mike, go ahead.
Well, first off, I wanted to thank Modell's and Farmingdale for getting my Michael Conforto shirt in. Second off, it has been fun. I will agree with you that. And third off, if Terry Collins can manage correctly, would be fine. But it's just concerning me with him. He's getting old. Does he have Alzheimer's or something? That's a question to keep in mind.
Well,
that's my final word.
All right. Well, Terry is he's never gonna, as somebody once said, he's never gonna be Miller Huggins, you know. But they like him, and hey, they are National League champions. So, Gary, what's your final word?
I'm gonna say faith. Keep the faith. It's a long season, and like you said, Rich, it's fun right now. Enjoy it. Because it could last, it could may not last, but just keep the faith that it's going to last and have a good time, go to the ballpark, enjoy the fresh air and being out, even though we froze our butts off the other night. That's what it's all about. It's certainly you want your team to win, but it's about being there and doing something and sharing that time with your friends, family, or whatever, and just taking in the nice air and the green grass and enjoy it.
Amen. All right, Mr. LeColin, my fellow esteemed colleague at Rising Apple, what's your last word tonight?
Location, location, location. You've heard me say, and you're going to hear me say for the millionth and 20th time now, you can't win pennants in April, but you can lose them. Location. You know, the Mets are half a game out of first place, and it's the end of April, and that's a good place to be. Location.
And on top of that, as I'm going to do every time I get this opportunity, it's time for the Mets to erect a memorial for Mrs. Joan Payson.
Amen.
I'm with you, too. And
yep.
You know what? I can't add to that because not only do they need, I guess I am adding to it, not only do they need a Joan Pace Memorial, they need one for Seaver and Staub. And so, Mike, I agree with you. And every time you say it, I'm going to say they need three. They need Payson, they need Seaver, and they need Staub. So, anyway, with that said, guys, it's next time we do this, it'll be the month of May. We'll be into the second month of the baseball season. So let's enjoy it now. Things are looking good. And as we always end the show, let's go Mets and good night.
Good night.
Let's go Mets.
Good night. Let's go Mets.
Good night now.